Today is October 15th, 2011, and we are located right now in the Wolfman Jack studio at KRE in Berkeley. And I'm talking to Professor Gordon Greb, who just finished receiving an award from the Bay Area Hall of Fame for being an outstanding educator. I'm Mike Adams. I'm talking to Gordon, and we usually start these with what is called the backstory. I know that you are a native of the area. Maybe a few words about your birth and your growing up.
Well, I was born actually in a farmhouse in Irvington, California, on August the 7th, 1921. And when I was delivered by a country doctor in a buggy. And the first thing that happened to me that's sort of a news story is that the doctor's handwriting was so scribbly that when they entered the name in the birth records, nobody could really read it. And so when I decided to join the military after Pearl Harbor, I needed to produce my birth certificate. Well, I went down to the Alameda County Courthouse to get it, and they couldn't find it. And all of a sudden, I thought, hey, was I adopted and my parents never told me? What's going on here? Well, I insisted, you know, that I was born in this court, in Southern Alameda County, in this farmhouse. It had to be me. I mean, look. So they finally looked at all the different records and found out that a baby had been born on this date in this little town of about 500 people, and they said, well, that must be you, but you better get your parents to get a lawyer to sign certain legal papers to verify that you're the child. So I started off life as kind of a mistake.
So you were born in this area, but you really left the area, right? I mean, maybe you grew up here, maybe in the 20s or 30s, maybe you were involved with radio somehow. Is that possible before you left the Bay Area? Did you...
Oh, yeah. Well, I grew up in the Bay Area. I grew up in Oakland, went to Oakland Public Schools, graduated from San Leandro High School. And before I even went to San Leandro, I was a cartoonist and had my cartoons printed in local papers. And I won a contest that was conducted by a radio station, KTAB, in Oakland, California. In 1934, the program was about flying an airplane and having adventures on a program called Rusty Boy Aviator. And it was broadcast every afternoon at 5:15 over this KTAB station, which had studios also in San Francisco. Well, the winner of the cartoon contest was, you were brought to the station to be interviewed, but on the air. Well, what happened is that they interviewed me and found out that my voice was similar to that of Rusty. And Rusty was then leaving for a job with NBC, so they offered me the job. Well, wow. What a stroke of luck. But first of all, I had to get permission from my parents. How was I going to do it? Well, they figured out I could take the streetcar after school to downtown Oakland and rehearse it before we went on the air. Everything was fine. And we had a sponsor called Dr. Corley's So Clean Toothpaste. But then I got the measles. And since programs in those days were live, and they had no replacement for me, the program went off the air. Hmm. So that's when I got into radio. It's also when I got out of radio. And it wasn't until 1942 that I got back into radio.
Okay. And what happened? That was World War II. You were probably somehow drafted, right?
I mean... No, I volunteered.
Ah.
What I did is I volunteered for the officer training program for the Navy, the Air Corps, the Marine Corps. I even memorized the Marine Corps hymn. But because I wore glasses and had poor eyesight, they were very fussy. They had so many volunteers that I couldn't make it. So when the time came for me to join the Army, which is my last hope, I had a stroke of luck. As I sat in the waiting office, I could look down the hallway, well, through a doorway, and I could see the eye chart. And with my glasses on, I could read the eye chart all the way down to the last line. So I took my glasses off and put it in my pocket. When I was called in there, the eye doctor said, "Now, what can you read on the eye chart?" I said, "Well, I can read the big E," and I said, "Pretty much all the rest of it, including the last line." And so I was ready to repeat the last line, the bottom line, and the doctor said, "Son, where did you put your glasses?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "I know you're wearing glasses because I can see the indentation right there in your nose." So I thought, well, now I'm going to get in the Army. But the Army didn't care. He said, "Now put your glasses on and now read the eye chart." So with my glasses on, I could read the eye chart, and he took me. Mm. So that's how I volunteered. But what I volunteered for was the Enlisted Reserve Corps. And so this enabled me to continue studies at Berkeley, California at UC until I was called to duty in March of 1943. And then I went into the military then. But before I went into the military, I had been on the radio every week on a program sponsored by San Leandro newspaper, and the program is called Observing the News. And we put it on KROW, and I had a partner named David Hauser, who was a sports writer for the newspaper, and I was also a writer for the newspaper in the summertime, full-time and part-time during my school years. And so that's how I got into radio, back into radio at KROW.
As a print journalist, starting as a print journalist.
Well, I started as a print journalist, yes. But the newspaper had a program on KROW that played only music. And I thought, well, why not have news? Yeah. So let's ask the publisher if we could rewrite the news. The paper came out every Friday. If we went to the editorial offices at Thursday night, all the copy would be done because the paper would be rolling off the press that night. And Dave and I would rewrite all this copy into a 15-minute program, and then we would do it live the next morning on KROW. So while the newspaper was being delivered to the doors and the homes of the people in East Bay, Dave and I were doing our radio program.
Now, this was in the late 30s, early 40s?
This is 1942.
1942, okay. And did you ever see active duty in the Army?
Oh, yes. I was in for 3 years.
Yeah. Well, did you do radio in the Army? Were you a
news
person?
Well, not at first. No, at first I had basic training at Fort Knox, Kentucky in the Armored Forces. And at that time, it so happened I was called up with other members of ERC, and there were a lot of college students. So many of us qualified for officer training program. But at the same time, the Army was interested in taking high-quality young men and giving them specialized training in foreign languages, in medicine, and psychology, and that they thought that could be used in Europe to assist in the victory in Europe, and particularly maybe with the Army of Occupation. So I was sent to Ohio State at Columbus, Ohio. And it was while I was there that I took basic engineering. Well, that program only lasted for about 6 months, and then they needed men to form some new divisions to carry on the battle in Europe. And so I was activated and sent off to the 102nd Infantry Division. And we began our training at Camp Swift, Texas, in 1944.
Now, were they training you? Did you eventually get trained to be a journalist in the Army? Or
no,
a radio
I was strictly a GI, infantryman, to be a fighter on the front lines.
Wow.
But the thing is, in the early stages of our training in Texas, we were out in a stormy weather, and I had just recovered from the flu a few weeks earlier. And I guess my resistance was low because what happened is I became quite ill, and so ill, in fact, that I had to be hospitalized. And they discovered I had a deadly case of pneumonia. Mm. So, in fact, it was so bad, they sent a telegram to my parents that said, "Your son is hospitalized and not expected to live." And as a Roman Catholic, they called in a priest, and I was put in a private room where I was supposed to die. So the priest came in and gave me the last rites, but my psychology was, I didn't know I was dying. I was so happy that to be in a hospital, somebody's taking care of me, that psychologically I was happy to see anybody, including the priest, and all the mumbo-jumbo that went with the last rites. But what saved my life was medical science. They gave me some newfangled drug, I don't know if it was penicillin or what, but it saved my life. And consequently, though, I was sent off eventually. I'd lost a lot of weight, had a scar in my lung, but still showed up on x-rays for years thereafter. and therefore they put me in a rehabilitation program. And it was 105 days in this program to build you back up. And by the time I got my strength back, and they put me on the last train to catch up with my division, which was being shipped off to Europe, I arrived at Fort Dix, New Jersey, just a few weeks before they were to ship out. And when they took a look at my my records, they thought, well, this guy has not had this training in machine guns. He's not having had gas attack drills. He hasn't, you know, driven a tank. Drop him off. So I was dropped off into what is called a casual company, which is composed of the most interesting, weird kind of bunch of people you ever saw in your life. And all we, they didn't know what to do with us, except figure out who needs, just, so I got tired of picking up cigarette butts. They used to, you know, police the area, and the area was so clean that you could eat your breakfast on it. So I went to the captain and said, sir, I'd like to write a feature story for the camp newspaper because there are an awful lot of interesting characters in this, as there were, in the casual company. Well, the captain is really, what he wanted to do is get rid of as many of these people as possible. So he thought, you write. I said, yes, I was a reporter on a newspaper. So he called the headquarters of the camp at Fort Dix and said, well, I got a man here who claims he can write stories for newspapers. Could you use him? And I guess the public relations officer must have said, yes, send him over to the paper. So the captain ordered his Jeep driver to take me, a private, over to the Fort Dix Post editorial offices, where they had just shipped out half the staff. He was desperate for anybody that could come in and help write stories. I walked in the door just in time. And so he had me sit down and show that I could do what I've said I could do, write stories, and he said, you're hired. And so that's how I got on the staff of the newspaper. And the newspaper happened to be in a building that also had radio studios. And the radio studios were used to record big 16-inch transcriptions that were used, supplied to local radio stations to promote the Army. And there I was, radio station on one side, newspaper on the other. And so since I'd had some radio experience, I spent a lot of time over the radio station doing programs.
So you're talking about this is after the war ended, in the middle 40s?
Well, no, this was still while the war was off.
Well, now so you had radio training in the Army, basically, or you worked for radio in the Army, and then when you got out of the Army, did you decide to go back to school or to work in radio?
I went back to school. I had one semester left at UC Berkeley. And so while I went back to Berkeley to finish my degree in journalism, I also got together with Dave Hauser, who came back. He had been in uniform, too. And we resumed our program, observing the news over KROW.
Okay.
And Russ Coughlin was there at that time as a young announcer. And Bruce Sedley and others who became part of Broadcast Legends later on in life were there. And I began to really get acquainted with some of the great talent that the Bay Area produced for broadcasting in the future.
So you worked in Bay Area radio then throughout the 1940s into the early 50s, is that
right?
Yeah. Yeah, what were some of the stations where you were working?
Well, what I did is after I graduated, I needed a full-time job rather than just doing the short weekly program on KROW. So they were putting new stations on the air after the war, and one of them had been licensed to San Rafael. And the call letters were KTIM. TIM stands for This is Marin. So I applied for this job, and I needed an audition disc. And so Russ Coughlin at KROW cut my first audition disc. And this, plus my experience previously in the Army doing radio and also KROW, got me the job. And so I became news director as well as, I did all kinds of programs. I did musical programs, DJ programs, interview programs and news on KTIM in 1947.
And you eventually went to a San Jose station, I know, but when did you decide to kind of teach more than work in radio? I mean, how did that happen that you were a professor all of a sudden?
I didn't choose education right away. I went from KTIM to KVSM. That's the Voice of San Mateo station. And the reason I went there is that KVSM decided that maybe they could have a better chance at selling time, getting more commercial sponsorship, if they moved the station from San Mateo across the bay to San Leandro. which they did. But first of all, they wanted to try it out by putting in some studios in San Leandro to do some programs there and see how many people they could get to sponsor the program and whether it would be feasible to move the station. So I happened to be available at that time and was chosen to be manager as well as the announcer. And my manager meant I went out and had to sell time. Mm-hmm. But the program itself, which was on the air from 4 to 6 p.m. every afternoon, which was drive time, I did with a portable control board with, you know, two turntables and records and sure. microphone. And so it was my show to create any way I wanted to. And what I learned from that was not only that it was a lot of fun, and I could play the kind of music I liked, but also I found that going out and seeing sponsors or trying to get sponsors, you would be asked a question, how many people listen to your station? And, well, how would you know? I mean, there were a few companies that were presumably measuring, doing audience research, but we didn't have one. And so I had a guess in terms of how much fan mail we got, or I even suggested to people, if you're driving by the station in your car on East 14th Street, because our studios were actually in the window of the newspaper office, honk your horn. So when the horn began honking quite frequently between 4 and 6, I thought, well, I guess we got a pretty good audience. But I really wanted to know mathematically and technically and factually how big the audience was. And so I had GI Bill for more education left. And I had kept in touch with professors at UC Berkeley who put me in touch with the director of the School of Journalism in Minnesota. And they offered me a teaching assistantship back at Minnesota because they wanted someone with radio experience to assist in the laboratory while, you know, I work for my higher degree. So I took a leave of absence from KBSM to go back to study survey research methods, which means measuring public opinion with the audiences for radio and then television. And that took me out of radio and put me back into education. And the minute I got into the university as a teacher, in fact, instead of being a teaching assistant, the director of the school put me in the classroom to teach a course. And what I had to do is I said, well, what do I teach? And he so opened up the college catalog and he read me a description of the course of news writing and said, there it is. So what I had to do is actually put together my own program of lectures and exercises for our news writing class. And at the same time, I was the laboratory assistant for the man who had the radio news writing class. So I was teaching basic newspaper writing in the morning, Monday through Friday, but also doing the laboratory of preparing news for the university radio station. So there I was doing both radio and taking courses in higher education, including what I wanted to do, which was the higher education on the survey research.
So you after you finished that, you came back to the Bay Area, right?
I came back to the Bay Area.
And did you work at KLIV first or go to San Jose State first?
What I did when I came back to the Bay Area, I needed I had offers to teach at Rutgers University, University of Georgia, or Boston College. But I had enough of the summer and winters of Minneapolis. I mean, freezing cold in the winter, which as a Californian I was not accustomed to, and blazing heat in the summer. So I thought, I'm crazy not to go back to California. So I turned down all the job offers to go back to California and went to the student employment office where, as a graduate of Cal, they would help you find work. And they had an opening for someone who could teach journalism and radio at San Bernardino Valley College. And so that's how I went down to San Bernardino and began teaching in the community college.
You didn't stay there long, though, right?
I stayed there only a year because Minnesota had an opening to be filled at the University of Oregon for a professor. So I couldn't turn down an offer for a professorship at Oregon. And so that's why I left.
But before I left, stay at Oregon.
But I must say, before I left, I had met a beautiful young girl named Darlene Alcock. And I had to write her a letter.
Is that her out there?
After I got my master's degree,
yeah.
I wrote an airmail letter to her, who was in Hawaii, and proposed to her, because I wasn't going to go back to San Bernardino and see her again. So fortunately for me, I'm a pretty good writer, and I guess maybe she thought, well, I'll take a chance on this guy, and although I've never listened too much to his radio program, I'll give him a whirl. So I went down and got married to Darlene and took her up to Oregon. And the reason I didn't stay up there, I'll tell you why. My wife is from Southern California. She spent her summers at Redondo Beach or Laguna Beach. I loved the sun. And the rain of Eugene, Oregon drove us back south again. So fortunately, there was an opening at KNX, and I applied for that and was hired to work as a newsman at KNX Columbia Square in Hollywood.
Big time.
Yes, I was there when I Love Lucy was being filmed, and a lot of it was a ground floor of television as well as the bright days of broadcast journalism when Edward R. Murrow was the chief of the news division back in New York. And at that time, I was urged to go back to New York. Well, again, as a Californian, I mean, I like it in California. So I stayed there until McCarthyism sort of gave me a hard choice to make, which was I signed all the paperwork to be a full-time employee with CBS. I loved the work. And the news director said my work was terrific. While I was there, I did some of the newscasts that were on the air at the time of Steve Allen, when Steve Allen was starting out as a brilliant young talent in radio, and then he finally moved back to New York. And I could name half a dozen of the great names that were at CBS at that time.
But did McCarthyism business in any way affect you?
It affected me because I happened to be an old-fashioned American. Thanks to my father, who also is an old-fashioned American, he was a great believer in Abraham Lincoln, and we, for birthday presents, my family always gave him Carl Sandburg's set of works on Abraham Lincoln, plus the fact he was thoroughly versed in the U.S. Constitution, Bill of Rights. So among the paperwork that I was required to sign by CBS was, of course, that if you invent anything while you're on the job, CBS is the property of the CBS. If you invent anything off the job, CBS has first refusal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in going through the paperwork, I came across this document that said I'm supposed to sign a loyalty oath, which said something to the effect, I am not now and never have been a member of the Communist Party and advocated violent overthrow of the government. I happen to know something about oaths. And oaths have been used historically by bad government to suppress freedom of speech and freedom of thought. And being very idealistic and also a firm believer in the Bill of Rights, I thought this was an infringement upon my rights as a free American. And so what I did is I typed up a substitute, since I'd served 3 years in the military. And if I was a volunteer, maybe I could submit to CBS the same oath as that taken by the President of the United States. You don't ask the President of the United States to take an oath that I I don't belong to a Communist Party or violent over. You don't do that. You ask the President to swear, I hereby promise and sign, I agree to uphold the U.S. Constitution and to defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So I wrote something similar to that and submitted it as a substitute for what they wanted me to sign. And I also added an amendment, which I said, on the reverse side of your required oath, you have a list of several dozen organizations, maybe 36 or 40, that the Attorney General of the U.S. has decreed are subversive, and anyone who's belonged to this, you've got to agree that you haven't belonged to them. Well, I'd already knew that from recent press accounts, this list by the Attorney General was unconstitutional. So I simply told CBS, you can't ask anybody to agree to to this list because no government can do this. So what they did is they got the lawyers off the golf courses in New Jersey because I refused to sign it. The news director said, Gordon, your work is as good as anybody here that I've had who's worked and written for the New Yorker magazine. And he wanted to keep me. His name is Jack Beck. And then they sent me up to see the, not only the general manager of the station, KNX, which is a great station, and the flagship station on the West Coast for the CBS network. It turned out he had been a manager at WCCO in Minneapolis, where before I left Minnesota, they had offered me a job to work there. And I knew the news director of WCCO, who eventually became news director of the CBS network. So we had friends in common. And he wanted me to sign it. Well, just why did you just sign it? I mean, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything.
You were sticking to principles.
So I just, but fortunately, my wife, who came from a good Republican family, who are certainly not radicals, supported me in this. And I said, you know, I may lose this job. And she said, whatever you decide, Gordon, we're with you. So they finally reached the point where the higher-ups at CBS decided, well, anybody who won't sign this has got to go. So when I lost the job there, I thought I'm going back to higher education and find out if I'm right about the Constitution. So my wife had gone to Stanford, and I said, well, I went to Cal Berkeley, why not try Stanford? So I went to Stanford and enrolled in the graduate program in political science and made constitutional law one of my specialties, and found out that I was right. I lost my job, but I was legally right. And eventually, when these oaths went through the court system, the courts agreed with me. But the good news is, by choosing to go to Stanford for 3 years, I had a wonderful education from the best professors you could possibly ask for. And at that time, I had done my master's thesis on movie censorship. You see, again, I'm a stubborn idealist and a liberal Democrat. And when I found out during my Army experience, who moved me around from state to state, movies in America were being censored. In Ohio, when I was in Ohio, it said this movie's been approved by the Ohio State Board of Censors. And I go to Pennsylvania, another thing on the screen was approved by the Pennsylvania Board of Censors. Go to the movies in New York. I thought, wait a minute, I didn't know we had censorship in the United States. What is the First Amendment all about if it doesn't say freedom of the press, freedom of the speech, freedom of association, and all of that? I mean, the First Amendment should apply to all media. How come it doesn't apply to the movies? So I mentioned this to a professor at Minnesota when I was choosing my master's thesis. He said, his name was Fred Siebert, by the way. He was not only a PhD, but he also had a degree in law. He said, Gordon, the Supreme Court has already ruled that censorship is legal. And it was a decision made in 1915, Ohio State versus Mutual Film Corporation. It was a 9-0 unanimous decision upholding censorship. And Hollywood had tried, when sound came to the movies, they said, oh, now we got sound, it's freedom of speech. They couldn't get first base with that. The court still, the lower courts or wherever it went, turned it down. Meantime, the censors were cutting out this and cutting out that and cutting the other thing. And so I made that my thesis. Again, I was warned. I mean, you're tackling a subject where the Supreme Court has ruled. How are you going to? I said, I'll just get the Supreme Court to change its mind. So after finishing the thesis and being approved, saying, well, this is a damn good. By the way, to finish the thesis, I studied at the libraries of Minnesota, UC Berkeley, and then I ended up at the Library of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in Los Angeles. And I collected my evidence, I made my case, and then I had this thesis. And I didn't want it to sit on the shelf gathering dust. I thought, someday I'm going to use this thing. So while at Stanford, a story came out in the Palo Alto Times, the Supreme Court at last accepted a new case out of New York, where a movie had been censored called The Miracle. But the New York Supreme Court had ruled censorship was permissible, again, based on the 1915 decision. So I fired off an airmail letter to a guy named Burstyn, who was the distributor of this film, and the film was being censored on the grounds that it was sacrilegious. So I said, I've done a thesis on this, and I believe you might be interested in it, because I thoroughly believe movies should have the same freedom as the press. I also had surveyed the leaders of Hollywood, including Ronald Reagan, who was Screen Actors Guild president, and the head of MGM and Paramount, and writers and directors, and they all agreed with me that movies should have the same freedom under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as newspapers and magazines and the print media. So with this backing of the industry, I sent the thesis off to the people who were fighting this case before the Supreme Court and never heard a word for 3 or 4 months, until one day a friend of mine, a graduate student from Stanford who was working for the Palo Alto Times, called me and said, Gordon, he knew what I was doing, you've done it. I said, what? He said, you've won that Supreme Court case. I said, you're kidding. How close was the decision? I thought, did we do it 5-4? He said, no. The decision was 9-0 against censorship. Boy, what a victory that was. So then I wrote to the lawyer and said, back in New York, and the firm was called London and London, did you use my thesis, and what way did you use it? And he sent back a glowing letter saying, your thesis was invaluable to me, and frankly, I must compliment you. I've never seen anything written so legally brilliant by someone who's not a lawyer. And then I said, in what particular way did you use it? And then he gave me an example. Against one of the leading constitutional lawyers of in the oral argument, those upholding censorship argued that Morris Ernst said, well, Hollywood really doesn't care for censorship. I mean, they don't mind it, because if it's banned in Boston, then it's a good publicity thing to say, well, see this movie, which is banned in Boston. So my attorney, I call him my attorney, was able to talk about this authority. Oh, but we have this great authority from Stanford University. Of course, I was only a teaching assistant then, but who did this thorough research. And I mean, he had evidence here, and they had all these letters from Ronald Reagan and Dorry Sherry and others that proved. So that's now we're off of radio into movies.
Yeah. So I want to have to get to the Herald research, but what it seems like is that you went from just a journalist and an observer and writer of news to somebody who was doing research and crafting opinions, doing scholarship.
That's right.
So this would be perfect for you to get a job at San Jose State or some other permanent kind of job. So we need to go to your university career and how you did your research, your further research into broadcasting. What you're known for, your signature moment.
Well, from Stanford, the GI Bill ran out. My wife got pregnant with our first child, so she had to quit teaching. So I needed a job. And there was an opening in San Jose at KSJO for a news director. And that's when I got back into radio, and I decided to try to make radio a great news source. Yeah. And I enjoyed it so thoroughly that San Jose State got interested in me and offered me a job to teach the radio course, which was one unit course. And once I got back on campus again, I convinced Dwight Bentel, who was the head of the journalism school, that we should really offer a degree program in radio and television journalism. And that's how within 6 months, he said, I think that's a good idea, Gordon. Can you do it? So I went half-time at the radio station. And for a year or so, I was in radio, but going full-time in San Jose State. And ultimately, I had to make a choice as to which was it going to be, stay in broadcasting or go into education. And that's when I chose to go into education full-time.
Okay. And you started the broadcast news sequence at San Jose State. You started the television as well as the radio sequence.
That's right.
But with your background in broadcasting and your scholarly research at Stanford in Minnesota, you were kind of the guy to discover some very original research.
Well, we're talking now about something I discovered actually when I was at the radio station. I wanted to do some feature stories on the history of San Jose and Santa Clara Valley. So I went down to the city museum, which was run by a curator named Clyde Arbuckle, who was a walking history book. And as we went through the exhibit, I was looking for a feature story. He held up this funny-looking, oversized telephone speaker, and he said, "This is the microphone from the first radio station, which was here in San Jose way back in 1909. And I looked at it, and I thought, something's wrong here, because all the history books say radio started with KDKA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in 1920. So I said, that's very interesting, but show me your Indian exhibit. And I ignored it. So it wasn't until I was full-time at San Jose State in journalism, I became advisor to a student group that wanted to honor famous journalists. And the group was called Sigma Delta Chi. So hitherto, they had always put up a plaque for some newspaper publisher like William Randolph Hearst, or some great writer, or reporter, or editor. I thought, well, what about a radio? And what about this claim by Clyde Arbuckle? So I sent one of my students over to see Clyde to say, what's the evidence on this radio station you said existed here? So my student, Tony Taravello, went over and saw Clyde. Clyde opened his file drawers and began to pull out some records. And Tony came back and said, "Mr. Greb, I think you better go over and see Clyde, because he's got an awful lot of stuff on this. I think maybe it happened." So that's all of a sudden, it was like walking into quicksand, because I began to discover something happened here that nobody knows about. I mean, it's lost to history, and if it's true, it's going to really upset the whole history of radio, because radio actually began here in the Bay Area in San Jose. So that's when I saw Dwight Bendel. I said, "Dwight, I need some time off to check this out." And he said, "Well, Gordon, we'll try to work with you on this." So that's when I began to use my tape recorder to try and find people. First of all, I wanted to find the records. And I found out that the station had become KQW, which had become KCBS. So I called KCBS. Though, well, surely they must have in a big trunk all the records of their station.
Yeah.
So I called the station and asked to see talk to the manager. And I gave him the background on this, and I said, "Well, can I have access to your records? Because they go back to 1909, and you're the first radio station." "What are you talking about?" said Maury Webster, who was the station manager. "I've never known this." I said, "Well, it's true." And I said, I've found in some books and other documents, this is what happened. I thought maybe I could find maybe Harold's original records if I could find his widow or his children. So they got busy and began asking around. And some of the old timers at KCBS said, "Oh, yeah, sure, everybody knows Charles Harold started the station." "Well, why didn't you tell us, you see?" So Maury Webster was a wonderful guy, because he loved radio, and particularly, and he was the manager of a station that probably historically was the very first one in the world. So he cooperated with me 100%. He did everything. He came down to San Jose to see me, and at that time I was still had a strong association with KSJO, where I'd installed a beeper telephone so that you could record interviews over the phone, provided there was a little beep on the line to let the interviewer knower that you're being recorded. So he told the engineer, put one of these things at KCBS. So I had some influence on starting KCBS as an all-news radio station, because Maury Webster wanted to improve the news-gathering capability. Anyway, let me just say, with the cooperation of KCBS, they began to broadcast over the air. If anybody remembers KQW back in the old days and Charles Harold and this, that, and the other thing, please contact us.
This was the 1950s.
This was 1958, 59.
Yes.
And
when those people were still alive.
They were still alive.
Right.
And I found Mrs. Sybil True was her name. They said somebody came in here one time named True, whose original name was Sybil Harold. And we've got her address. I said, "Where is it?" So I had her son's address, and the son lived about 5 blocks where I did in San Jose. I went over to his house with my tape recorder, and he came down the steps with a cardboard box full of all of his dad's newspaper clippings, photographs, records, and letters.
Robert True. This is
Robert True.
The son of Charles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was so excited that I didn't know what to say other than I went through the thing and said, "I need to borrow some of this stuff because it's so precious. I want to get it copied." In those days, we didn't have copy machine. So what I did is I got the photo lab in journalism to actually take photographs and negatives of some of these original documents.
You do microfilm, right?
Sort of, yeah. Well, anyway, our next big interview was with Mrs. True, or Mrs. Harold, who was still alive. She was in her 60s, and she lived nearby, too. So I took my tape recorder over to her house, and this lovely lady, she was just a gracious, lovely lady, gave me an hour and a half of interviews and memories of being not only with Doc Harold, but when she did the radio programs. I said, "You were on the air?" She says, "Oh, yes. I did this little program for Hams every Thursday night," she said, "I think around 8 o'clock. And I would play these records for them and to take requests. And then I would go down to Sherman and Clay and get the records for the next week's program. And I had a little audience out there for my weekly program." So I suddenly realized that while Harold and his associates, his young men that were on the microphone, were doing a lot of testing by playing records, they hadn't created a show. I mean, sometimes they would read news stories out of the newspaper, sometimes they would just talk, sometimes they play a record. But Mrs. True actually put together a show. So she was not only the first female disc jockey, she probably was the first lady or woman, human being to ever do a program, a show.
This is about 1910, 1911 when she got involved.
No, she was doing this after her little baby was born. Harold married her. She was a student at the San Jose Normal School.
Yeah.
And I think that the baby was born around 1913.
Yeah, okay.
So I think the program was on somewhere around 1912 or 13. I don't know whether she did it before she had the baby or not. Mm-hmm. But I do know this, that she brought the baby down to the station, and someone with a movie camera took a picture of the baby crying into the microphone. Mm-hmm. And she said it was probably the first baby ever to cry on the radio.
Which we used in the book.
That's right.
Charles Harold, inventor of radio.
Yeah, that film was in the cardboard box that the son brought down. And it was a strange width. It wasn't a normal 16 millimeter, even 35 millimeter. Mm-hmm. So I think you, Mike Adams, got it changed to the proper width, didn't you?
Yeah, I found someone here who printed it a frame at a time onto 16 and then copied the video.
So it's part of your documentary, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I've got a lot to say here. Tell me when
Bill,
I've said
enough.
Bill,
do you have any questions you want to ask?
No, just...
Well, one of the things that Maury Webster did for me for KCBS was Lita Forrest was still alive. And so Lita Forrest was considered the father of radio. And so we thought, there were certain correspondence that showed that Harold had written to and corresponded to Lita Forrest, particularly after 1915, when Harold, to demonstrate his radio station and its capabilities, he was asked by the radio inspector, when Lita Forrest had a booth to demonstrate his transmitter and his radio receiver. And the radio receiver worked, but the transmitter didn't work. So the radio inspector of San Francisco called Doc Harold and said, "You know, is it possible that you could broadcast every day and night, you know, hour after hour, so that Lee DeForest could pick up your programs on his receiver for his booth at the 1915 World's Fair?" So Harold said, "Sure, yeah, no problem." So his programs then from San Jose became what people were hearing on Lee DeForest's receiver at the Panama Pacific Exposition. So there was a certain amount of exchange in letters between Lita Forrest and Harold on that. And so that's why Maury Webster arranged for me to fly down to Los Angeles and arranged for a KNX team of engineers to go with me to interview Lita Forrest. And, of course, these radio engineers, they just wanted to meet Lita Forrest like nothing because he was one of the pioneers. So Lee DeForest was an old man and a good memory, but he thought I was there to talk about his great work. And I had to keep moving if I could. Well, your association with Harold. Because at the World's Fair of 1939, he spoke to a gathering, a convention of radio pioneers, in which he gave Harold credit as having been the first broadcaster. And he did this on the basis of correspondence that he had with Harold, because Leda Force at one time was in Palo Alto in 1912, very close to Harold. So I wanted to find out what he could say on tape that would illuminate the association. So that's what we did.
And the recording?
We got it recorded on tape and took it to the KNX studios, then cut it down to a short, usable piece, and we sent it up to KCBS to be used on their commemorative broadcasts. And years later, when I was in Chico, California, a letter came to, I don't know where, but I was asked by the Germans that had a public broadcasting station, they wanted to honor Lee DeForest too, and someone heard out that I'd interviewed him. So I took this tape over to KCHO, which is the public broadcasting station in Chico, and we dubbed it off onto a CD and sent it over to Germany. So that was, you know...
That's a very important recording.
Yeah.
Unless we...
In an archive
I'll give it to you. If you...
Unedited,
yeah.
The whole thing.
The whole thing, yeah. So mostly he just says, I mean, he doesn't really say anything.
Oh.
He says very little.
I fed him some questions in which he said yes.
Yes.
So I said, well, then you will congratulate the station, KCBS, on the anniversary of being the world's first broadcasting station. And he said, well, yes, I congratulate. So he repeated what I said.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It was, he was very feeble.
Really?
He sounded very feeble anyway.
Well, he's not feeble in it because after the interview, as you know, he sent a letter to me addressed to the wrong university, saying in light of the fact that his opinions are valuable, he should be remunerated in some way. He wanted to be paid for the interview.
Yeah.
Well, frankly, in those days, and I think even today, news reporters do not pay people for interviews. So, sorry, Lee, but you're out of luck.
So
the letter never came to me until Mike Adams, who was doing a book on Lee DeForest, turned it up and said, Gordon, what about this?
Yeah, pay this, Gordon.
You owe money to Lee DeForest.
Here's the question. All this effort, and this is really your academic career and your scholarship, was the Harold story, which eventually there was a book and there was a documentary. What kind of influence do you think all this work had? Because today, it seems, one, that most students don't care that much about broadcast history, and the radio business isn't like it was. It's kind of, it's online, it's satellite. Does the Charles Harold story, do people know about it? I mean, what really happened?
No, it hasn't become the household word. And I agree with you that the younger generation is fascinated now with the new digital world. But I'll tell you what's interesting is that I've lived through more than one revolution. I mean, the same enthusiasm that little kids like my grandchildren have now for these iPads and iPods and iPhones, that same enthusiasm was there with the children, the young boys, when Harold was... I mean, where was the audience for this first station? There were little boys with crystal sets, and they were telegraph operators and radio code people doing Morse code on the ships that were anchored in San Francisco Bay or out in the Pacific Ocean. That was the audience for the first station. But Harold also had a school. Why did all these boys come to a school? Because they were crazy about this new technology where voices and music can go through the air. And I still feel that way. I feel that way about flying. And I just think it's ridiculous to take all this stuff for granted. I mean, it's wonderful. And I try to get young people to take a second look at it, just by talking about what the world was like before we had radio, before we had airplanes, before we had the telegraph, before we had automobiles. All this happened in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So I just hope that my enthusiasm for it is infectious, and that, and in some respects it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, so...
Well, you won an award today. You won an award as an educator.
Yeah.
And at that ceremony, there were dozens of people who came up to you and said, oh, I was in your class in 1960 or 1970. So you obviously had a big influence on Bay Area radio and television people.
Well, you know, if you go into teaching, you should know you're not going to make a lot of money. I mean, sure, if you want to make some money, that's pretty good. You might try to become an administrator, maybe an associate dean, like somebody I can think of.
There you go.
But you would work your way up to be a chancellor or a president. And so it takes you out of the classroom. So if you're going to be a teacher in the classroom, what's the payoff? Well, the payoff doesn't come right away, but it does certainly come. My treasure today, in fact, is the very fact that these students of mine, who are now grown, mature professionals, and I've seen them, as I predicted, I told my students, I want you, when I'm an old guy in a rocking chair, to be seated there in the anchor chair of Walter Cronkite, or Chet Huntley, or one of the great newscasters of that current period. I want you there. And if there's no reason why you can't be there, because you people, I mean, there's plenty of talent here, and I'm trying to teach you the professional rules of the game. I'm not going to turn you loose unless you are professionally trained. And so I expect you to go all the way to the top. And some of them have. And some of them, you know, still, there's a role to be. One of them, for example, is a station manager that I, you know, when you reach out to find out what happened to my students, they're all over the place doing some phase of broadcasting. I worked at KNX as a news writer. Well, one of my students is now the news director at KNX. I mean, what better legacy or treasure can you have?
Yeah.
And so that's the payoff. And I'm content with the pension I've got. I mean, unlike some of the rumors going around that public employees that work for the colleges and universities of California have these tremendous pensions, it just ain't so. But I have enough money to own a house and run a car and buy food at the grocery store and pay for the gas. That's all I want, and take an occasional trip now and then. And that's, I'm not anxious to be a millionaire. I'm happy in what I've did and what I've done. And so therefore, it's just golden to be able to meet these students again. And as right now, when I was presented with this award today and made a member of the broadcast Hall of Fame, I was so pleased that a number of the people who were there with me, including Mike Adams, who was my co-author on the book about Charles Harold, and Hal Ramey, who was a student of mine in doing sports for me, and I knew he was going to go up to the top when he was a student. And Sybil Harold was also honored today. And I'm glad that my interview kept her memory alive and that she's being honored. And Rush Coughlin, who cut my first audition disc. And so that it's a pleasure to still see the old-timers at this function who are still alive and healthy and announcing. I mean, Ken Ackerman of KCBS is 89 years of age, but he's still one of the great workers and that keeps the broadcast legends interesting every single time it meets. And that's my legacy, and I wouldn't trade it for anything else in the world.
I think it's a perfect place to end it.
Wonderful interview.
Thank you.
Great
Gordon
stories.
Greb. Gordon Greb, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I think it's a great place to end
we
it.
We really enjoyed this.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry I got off on the movies.
No, the movies. No, it's fine. We had an hour. We had an hour. No, it was fine because it made you a scholar. Took you from being just a news writer, a news reporter, to being a person who's a researcher. So it made a big difference. You know, you wouldn't have discovered, probably wouldn't have been that interested in the Herald story other than as a one-minute news story. But now you, as a result of your work with movie censorship, you begin to see research and how things fit together.
Yeah,
you begin to synthesize information into something new that you made a difference.
Well, so I mean, you're in the same, you're a historian yourself.
Yeah, sure.
You know, you wouldn't do what you're doing if you didn't love what you're doing.
That's right. I don't do it for money.
That's right. Yeah. We don't do it for money.
No. Not for those 200 books we sold.
Thanks again.
Yeah, okay.
No, thanks, Bill.